This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. How did people live in the Americas prior to the arrival of Europeans? Ideas about pre-Columbian civilizations have been under review in recent years. Archaeologists, anthropologists, and others are piecing together stories different from those most of us heard in school. Science journalist Charles Mann has written a book about this emerging picture of life in the Americas before Columbus. The title? 1491, New Revelations of the Americas Before Columbus. Charles Mann is our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. And listeners, I invite you to join our discussion today. I look forward to your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free. The toll-free number is 800-222-9455-800-222-WILL. Charles Mann, our guest, is a correspondent for Science and the Atlantic Monthly, the author of four previous books. He's been honored for his work with many awards. His writing was selected for the Best American Science Writing 2003 and the Best American Science and Nature Writing 2003. His book, 1491, was selected by numerous publications as Best Book of the Year. It is now available in paperback with a new afterword from Vintage Books. Charles Mann, by the way, will be in Chicago next week for a talk at the Field Museum. That event is set for Thursday, October 19th, 2006. Again, the phone numbers, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Charles Mann, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be with you.
You trace the roots of this book back more than 20 years ago when you made your first trip to some Maya ruins in Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula. Would you tell us about that trip?
Well, sure. I'm a correspondent in the news division of the journal Science. And for a story that I did, there's a group of scientists sponsored by NASA that were sampling the upper atmosphere to learn more about the ozone layer. And they had a flight that would go all the way from Hudson's Bay down by Tierra del Fuego. And it would go up super high, scoop up part of the atmosphere, bring it down, analyze it, and proceed in hops like this. And we landed in Merida in the Yucatan Peninsula. And for some reason, the scientists had a day off. I can't remember why. And we rented a car and decided to go look at these ruins that were, you know, told to us that we should go see. And I was stunned. I'd lived for a couple of years in Rome, and so I thought I had some standards of comparison. And these ruins that I was looking at were, you know, to my eye at least, equally sophisticated architecturally and aesthetically, and they were far larger than the ruins that I'd seen in Europe. And I couldn't believe it. I asked myself, why in school did I learn so much about Greece and Rome? And I don't even know if I even heard the word Maya in my high school, and yet this is, after all, in my own hemisphere. Mm-hmm. So I got curious and began going down there and using the journalist privilege to call up people and ask them what they were doing and researchers and ask what was going on.
Yeah. Give us some sense of what you saw there in those ruins.
Well, there are these, essentially, between 200 AD or earlier and 1200 AD, the entire central Yucatan was turned into a kind of urban agglomeration, a little bit the way that between Washington and New York is now, you know, sort of one city right after the other. And only the sort of big centers have been excavated. And in there, there's these very, very large temples. There's, you know, all kinds of stone structures, lots and lots of quite beautiful sculptures, many of them, you know, adorned with murals. It's really kind of eye-popping stuff.
Yeah. So from this fascinating and wonderful side trip on an assignment, this book was was born. I guess there was a little germ of the idea, perhaps.
Well, it was really just I got curious about it.
Yeah.
And as I talked to, you know, I would hornswoggle my editors into letting me go down there and find out more and writing articles about what the researchers were finding. And as I did this, I gradually realized that the picture that was built up that had been built up over the last 20 or 30 years by the anthropologists, archaeologists, ecologists, and you know other scientists who study this field was really different from what I had learned in high school. And then in the early 90s, my son went to high school, and he was learning the same things I had learned. And they were outdated when I learned them, and they're really outdated by the time that he learned them. And I thought, gee, somebody should write a book.
Yeah. Well, in 2006, what's going on in classrooms?
Well, I think that there hasn't really been that much change, although I believe things are beginning to come around. You know, the gap between what the scientists think and what's in the textbooks is beginning to close. I'm hoping that my book will have a small impact on that. But basically, you know, children still learn, as I did, that Indians walked across the Bering Straits 12,000 years ago, that they lived for the most part in small, scattered bands, that you know, kind of roamed around the countryside, and that when Columbus landed, the Americas, you know, the Indians had so little impact on the environment that when Columbus landed, the Americas were, for all intents and purposes, a wilderness. And one way to sum up the research of the last few decades is to say that scientists now believe that all three of these things are wrong. Indians are probably here far longer than previously believed, at least most scientists think so. They're here in far greater numbers than previously believed, and they had much more environmental impact than previously believed.
Okay. How long, how many, and what kind of impact?
Well, but, you know, I guess I should say read the book. That's what it's about. But, you know, I'll try to summarize it.
Yeah. This is really, you know, this was an ambitious undertaking for you to write this, and you did a marvelous job. But, you know, my job as an interviewer here, too, is difficult as well, trying to sort out, well, you know, what do we have to touch on?
Right.
You know, so we're kind of in the same canoe.
So to speak.
Yeah.
Right. Well, the, you know, let's talk to the first question, how long?
Mm-hmm.
And when you go to high school and they tell you about, what they tell you is that, and this is entirely true, that there was an ice age, starting, you know, sort of on the order of 20,000 years ago, and these massive ice sheets built up over Canada and the northern third of our country, and also the same over on the other side of the world, and so much ice was piled up there that the sea level, you know, it came from the sea, and the sea levels dropped, you know, as much as 300 feet, and low-lying areas on the shore were exposed, and one of these was the area between Alaska and Siberia, and it created what they call a land bridge. And because of the Japanese current, this land bridge was actually surprisingly warm. Summertime temperatures reached, in the 60s, which is really quite surprising because it's way far north. But what they don't tell you is that once you cross land bridge, so that, you know, when this land bridge was there, it was quite easy for people from Asia to walk across to the Americas, they would have hit parts that weren't warmed by the Japanese current. They would have hit these enormous ice sheets. There are, you know, basically 2,500 miles of ice between, you know, these paleo Indians, as they're called, and a place where you can get something to eat. And, you know, this would be the sort of thing that you would take a special National Geographic expedition to traverse now. And, you know, there'd be a TV special showing people with high-tech equipment, you know, going across this enormous ice field. And obviously they didn't have any of that. So what the theory is that there was this sort of magic time when the ice started to melt and the sea was rising, but it hadn't covered over the land bridge. And these two big ice sheets that covered North America kind of pulled back, and there was what they call an ice-free corridor between them. And there's a few centuries which people could sort of scoot across the land bridge before it got covered with water and shoot through this ice-free passage and then come to the Americas. And there's a number of problems that have surfaced with this idea, including something that's quite impressive to me, is that geologists have looked for evidence that the ice sheets performed in the way they need to make this theory work, and there doesn't seem to be much evidence for that. In addition, there is archaeological evidence way down in South America of people having lived practically in Tierra del Fuego at about the time that they were supposedly crossing through these ice sheets, and sort of hard to imagine that they would have walked across and somehow sprinted down the hemisphere. Mm. And genetic, you know, other kinds of indirect evidence, like genetic evidence and dental evidence and linguistic evidence, are typically saying that, you know, they probably came here 20 to 35,000 years ago, and since they couldn't have walked then, because of the reasons we mentioned, They had to have come by boat because they didn't fly, right?
Right.
But this is just a, you know, sort of a kind of a default picture. It's the only way people can imagine. It's not like there's actually any positive proof of this.
Yeah. And let's take, you know, 1491 as a point here now and talk about what do we know about how many people were living here in the Americas, in this hemisphere, half the world, after all.
Right. Well,
how do we theorize about that, or what's the evidence for that?
Well, it's pretty interesting. There's sort of, I'll tell you what, you know, 20 or 30 years ago, you know, sort of when I went to high school again, sort of mainstream belief was say 1970, was that there are probably fewer than 10 million people in the, 10 million people or thereabouts in the entire hemisphere. In other words, not very many people. Now, much more typical, and I think relatively conservative estimates are 40 to 60 million. So that's a big jump. And there's lots of people that are estimating even higher. And because these numbers keep creeping up, I wouldn't be surprised if when all, you know, the dust settled down, that the typical estimates would be 80 to 100 million in the hemisphere. So an order of magnitude more than was previously thought.
Hmm.
So, and obviously societies, you know, when you have 10 million people scattered across this enormous area, there's just not that many people here. When you start talking tens of millions, then you start having large-scale societies. You can't have hunter and gathering societies, you know, with 200,000 people in them. You know, this starts telling you have to have more complicated organizations. You have to have an infrastructure. You have to have all the kinds of stuff that you had in Europe and in Asia. So just the sheer numbers starts telling you a lot about, you know, what the Americas were like in addition to the numbers. Now, the evidence for that is kind of interesting. There's sort of two kinds of evidence. One is you people are gradually appreciating how much Native Americans modified the environment. And you know, I start the book with it describing this area in eastern Bolivia and western Brazil, which is right by the Andes, and you know, there's a lot of snow melts in the Andes, and it washes down and covers this large area with, you know, this sort of irregularly moving sheet of water, like a foot thick, and it's not pleasant to live in. And so the people who originally lived there built up these mounds, some of them as much as 70 feet tall. That cover a huge area. There's like kind of like an island archipelago they created. And then they created these straight-line berms that, you know, because it's not much fun to walk through knee-deep water, they created these little highways, not so little, actually, for them to walk across. And then they created these enormous networks of raised fields. The estimates I've seen are 16,000 square miles of raised mm-hmm. fields for their agriculture. And this enormous area has been, they've created a completely artificial landscape. And It's something that isn't done by a small group of people. Right?
Yeah.
You start having to raise the estimates of the population. The second way that they do it is that we do have certain dates at which people did conduct censuses after Columbus, and there's been a growing appreciation of how many people had to have died in the epidemics that Europeans accidentally brought with them. You know, for reasons that are kind of a historical quirk, smallpox, influenza, measles, all these kind of crowd diseases, as the scientists call them, didn't exist in the Americas. And Europeans brought them over with them, and they just swept through the countryside. And now scientists typically believe that something on the order of 75% to 90% of the Native American population died between, say, 1500 and 1650, something like that.
Hmm.
And then, so if you have an estimate of the population, you know, pretty good census for say, 1650 or 1700, you can reason backwards to say, wow, look at how many people must have been here before if this is a tiny remnant.
Yeah. The idea of disease taking so many lives is just amazing.
It's horrific, yeah.
It
was the greatest demographic catastrophe in history. And it was so large that, you know, it really is difficult to imagine. What happened was, about 15,000, this is sort of this amazing story, about 15,000 years ago, for reasons that nobody really has nailed down. I mean, scientists have, you know, cut down entire forests to print the journal articles in which they argue about it. But they do know that about 15,000 years ago, most of the large mammals, along with a bunch of other species in the Americas, died. And this included all the potentially domesticable animals. There were horses over here and camels and this sort of thing. And they all They all died, and as a result, Native Americans didn't have any domesticated animals except for llamas in certain areas and horses, and dogs, not horses. They didn't have horses. The reason this is important is that most of these kind of crowd diseases I was mentioning, like smallpox, are actually animal diseases that jumped over what they call jumped over the species barrier and became mm-hmm. human diseases. So, you know, horsepox or cowpox becomes smallpox, bovine rinderpest becomes measles, bird flu becomes human flu. That's in the headlines and that kind of thing. And none of this happened in the Americas. It all happened in Eurasia. And so when the Europeans came, they had this huge number of, you know, thousands of years sort of stored up diseases that exerted their entire impact all at once. And it was just an extraordinary, horrific thing. And there's an example of a smallpox epidemic that we know of that came in 1519 with Cortez, spread past the Aztec Empire, went all the way down into Central America and into the Inca Empire. This is before they'd seen any Europeans. And killed the Inca emperor, killed his designated heir, killed most of the court, killed, you know, 25 to 30% of the people in the empire, and set off this mammoth civil war. And this all happened before the Europeans.
Yeah. So to use the word decimate just doesn't even cover it. I mean, doesn't even begin to describe it. That means 1 out of 10. But
And this is 9 out of 10.
Yeah, 9 out of 10.
Or 8 out of 10 or something like that, yeah. And what this is the reason that so many of these societies were relatively easy for small groups of Europeans to conquer. They're just kind of blasted, and this is an enormous advantage for the conquistadors. That, you know, in a sort of this horrendous way, this convenient way for them, their societies would have been wiped out even before they showed up. And when people explore the American West, like the very first first Europeans to go into the Pacific Northwest, for example, that was and to map it, was the expedition of Captain Vancouver in the 1780s, and they found the place was a cemetery. They found bones all over the beaches, and they found emptied villages. And the reason was a few years before there'd been a horrible smallpox epidemic.
Hmm.
And this is why the Pilgrims were able to land, and the Wampanoag didn't kick them out. A shipwrecked French sailor, a few years before they arrived, had caused this epidemic. People speculated what it was. Viral hepatitis is the latest theory. But it seems to have killed 75% to 90% of the people in coastal New England. And when they landed, they set up shop, actually, on a deserted Indian village called Patuxet. And, you know, the land had previously been cleared. It was much easier for them. The first 50 settlements in New England were all set up on deserted in villages that have been emptied by disease.
Hmm. When the first encounters happened, and, you know, here we should note that the diversity of societies is just immense here in this story.
Yeah.
But can you give us some sense of what first encounters were like? How are the Europeans seen by the people in residence? You know, maybe you could give us a couple of different examples.
Well, it's kind of interesting to read the early chronicles. Say in the Northeast, where I'm speaking to you from, we know it's almost certain that fishermen from the Basques and the Basque area, and also from Britain, were in the general area before Columbus. And the earliest European accounts, early in the 16th century, describe people who had already been trading for a while with Europeans, and so they would, and the reception would depend on how much previous encounters they would have. So that when Verrazzano came up in the 1520s, and when he got to where Rhode Island is, he was a novelty. The Europeans were still a novelty, and they're treated extraordinarily well. Then he got up to Maine, where the Micmac had apparently seen all he could stand of Europeans, and they wouldn't let him anchor. They wouldn't let him, anybody stay on shore. They did want to trade with him, and so they passed a line to the boat, and they would send furs over that in return for knives and that sort of thing. And when the exchange was done, the Indians mooned them. and shouted and hooted at them. And so it was most disrespectful. And then when a little later, when the French set up these little trading posts, up and down the St. Lawrence River, there's lots and lots of commentary from the French sort of being annoyed that the Indians looked down on them. They thought they were, kind of stupid and smelly because the Europeans didn't bathe nearly as much as many Native American societies. Sort of these unquestionably inferior types. It's funny to be for Europeans to be regarded with the same kind of ethnocentrism that they were regarding the native populations were. Things are quite different, of course, in a place like Mesoamerica, where you had these large organized societies, very complex places like the Aztec Empire, and there. It's often written in the chronicles that the Europeans were regarded as gods. You probably heard this, that the Aztec emperor, Moctezuma, thought that Cortez was the incarnation of this god. Interestingly, that story was not ever reported by Cortez himself or any of the people who traveled with him. It sort of suddenly appears in the history books a century and a half later. And the likelihood is that they regarded them as visitors from across the sea. And since in those days both Europeans and natives believed that it was possible for ordinary people to have supernatural powers, the Europeans believed in witches and the Aztecs believed in the Mesoamerican equivalent. It's quite possible they're open to the possibility that these people had supernatural powers. At one point, Columbus's men apparently claimed this when they were dealing with some of the Taino in the Caribbean. And the Taino thought, "Oh, okay, if they're supernatural, they shouldn't be able to die." And so they shoved their heads underwater and wanted to see if they would drown. So there was a real kind of give and take and back and forth between them.
Why has it taken? As you mentioned earlier, these stories are still in history books today. Mm-hmm. Why is it taking so long? Why has it taken so long for a reexamination or an examination to begin with? Reexamining what we thought we knew about the Americas prior to the arrival of Europeans.
It's interesting. There's a terrific book by Francis Fitzgerald came out a while ago called America Revised, which is about how American history books have changed over time. And there's a little section in it about Native Americans. And you see the first textbooks in the beginning of the 19th century, and they treat Native societies as interesting and important, a major part of what children should learn about. And then as disease continued to ravage these people, it became sort of safer to regard them as being tucked into the dustbin of history and not worth bothering about, coincided with a long-term decline in population until about 1900, which was the kind of the nadir. That's when there was maybe a quarter of a million native peoples in the United States. And this kept pretty much untouched, this kind of mixture of ethnocentrism and patriotism, I think, kind of kept until the Second World War. And then historians learned, suddenly through the actions of countries like India and Japan, that these non-Western societies could have a big impact on Europeans. It wasn't just going to be the Europeans' way. When India rebels and throws off the British yoke and Japan comes and bombs us, it's an obvious thing. And I think the reason that for the last couple of decades that it's taken a while is not this kind of ethnocentrism, but sort of a quirk of academia in that, historians, the sort of colonial historians who write the history books are typically not trained to talk to anthropologists and archaeologists. There's remarkably little sort of interplay among the disciplines. One of the odd things for me is that I've gone to speak at some, universities, large state universities, and a couple times historians have come up to me and said, this stuff is really fascinating. How would I learn more about it? And, I'm glad they're asking, but at the same time, I'm kind of speechless. There's the entire departments at these universities that could tell them. And but because they're the ones who write the histories and they don't really know, the same stories kind of get told again and again. This is changing, I think.
Yeah. Is this examination, is this new evolving picture of life in the Americas, pre-Columbian Is it controversial? Are the people, once they're talking to one another, are they fighting with one another?
Well, you know, academics always fight, right? I mean, I guess that's part of the pleasure of tenure, that you can just have tremendous squabbles.
Yes.
Right? But, I'm sure your listeners know much more about this than I, the university. But there are also political implications. I mean, almost any kind of history has some kind of political implications. And I'll say the two that have been pretty interesting to me is that a few people on the political right have not liked the book, few, but by no means all. Because they regard this idea that the populations might be larger as an attempt to make, you know, Western society feel guiltier. You know, that this is an attack on dead white males. Do you see the logic?
Yes.
And then if you talk about their intellectual accomplishments, say that you point out that the Maya and other Americans, and the Olmec, I should say, you know, invented zero, you know, more than 1,000 years before it was heard of in Europe, then this is somehow equivalent to saying, you know, that Newton wasn't smart or something, and it's denigrating Europe. And on the political left, there's a certain number of people, certainly not all, but some, who regard the idea that if there's all these people, they had more environmental impact. That means the Americas weren't a wilderness, and that's going to be used by developers, you know, as an excuse to unleash the chainsaws and the bulldozers. And so this is wrong. You know, this place was a primeval wilderness, and so they regard this as a subtle intellectual attack on the very basis of environmentalism.
Mm-hmm. Science journalist Charles Mann is our guest this afternoon here in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. He is the author of 1491, New Revelations of the Americas Before Columbus. My name is Celeste Quinn, and listeners, I invite you to join our discussion this afternoon with questions, comments. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let's talk with a listener who's joining us this afternoon from Farmer City, Line 1. Hi.
Hi. You were talking of your travels to Merida and to see Uxmal and the areas around that. Have you ever been to Teotihuacan?
Teotihuacan, yeah.
Isn't it the most amazing place?
It's an extraordinary place. I should probably mention for listeners who don't know what it is, that it's a very, very large city that existed, you know, that it hit its height roughly in 200 AD, and it, just outside the location where Mexico City is now. And there's this enormous avenue we call the Avenue of the Dead, stretched for miles, that was kind of the central avenue. And alongside it are these palaces and two absolutely huge pyramids. And its population was, estimates of its population reach as high as 500,000, and various people argue about whether it was the largest city in the world at that time, or the second largest, or the fifth largest, or whatever.
Most Americans don't realize that, you know, in a four-hour plane flight, they're sitting on probably more history that they're totally unaware of in Mexico City and the surrounding areas than they could ever imagine, because they've never been told anything about it or taught about it. But, you know, there's the Great Pyramid at Cholula, that's the greatest pyramid in the world in height and in weight, and it's totally covered, and on top of it sits a huge Catholic church.
Right.
And this phenomenal amount of history down there, and Americans are totally not exposed to it. Maybe it's some hang-up they have because it's Mexico, but beyond that, it's the history between the area around Merida and then the area around Mexico City and then down around Oaxaca and in Palenque and all, that history is just it's just incredible.
I lived for a couple years in Rome, and I used to, you know, drive my little car around and sort of just was amazed at how the countryside and seems sort of, you know, saturated in history. I like the feeling that, you know, people had been here for thousands of years doing stuff and sort of try to imagine it sometimes. And I would think, like, gee, I wish we had this kind of feeling in, you know, where I live in the United States. And the fact is, we should.
Yeah.
You know, our land has been occupied by just as many interesting societies doing just as many interesting things. It's particularly evident in Mexico, but it's also true up here.
Yeah. Talk about Cahokia.
Yes, where you guys are.
Yeah, you describe Cahokia as a city of farmers. What an interesting way of thinking about it.
It's kind of incredible to me that Cahokia, which has some of the major earthen monuments, anywhere in the world, is like, no disrespect to Illinois, but I don't think it should be a state park. it should be a national treasure. It's really quite amazing. You have a very nice museum there, well worth seeing.
Yeah, I have yet to see it, but...
it's not far from you.
No, it's not. It's not
and
at all.
It's just outside St. Louis in Edwardsville, Illinois,
right.
And it's, well worth the time.
Yeah. And it wasn't all that long ago that these mounds that are, in this part of the country, they were endangered, and perhaps they still are, some of them.
Well, there are so many of them, there are thousands of these mound cities. I mean, Cahokia was by far the largest, scattered throughout the southeast and up the Mississippi Valley. And most of them, have been bulldozed or taken away, but there's still many, many that are left. And, again, it's puzzling to me why, school children don't learn about this. This is just an amazing fact. They're much more likely to learn about something like Stonehenge than what's in their own backyard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, we still refer to this hemisphere as the New World.
Right. And I guess, one way to summarize my book is to say, well, maybe you should think twice about using that loosely.
Yeah. How did you decide what kind of book you would write?
Well, it's funny. Just on a personal level, I think almost every writer tries to imagine who the reader is.
Mm-hmm.
In my case, I always imagined my dad, who was a businessman, and he was an active, curious guy, but also didn't want his time wasted. He wanted to be amused and told something that was thought provoking,
mm-hmm.
But not to be pompous about it, and to remember that the person who was reading it, had the alternative of switching on the TV. And he would sit in his armchair, and he had this place right beside him where, when stuff got to be boring or pompous or he felt like the author was preening, he'd throw it in the corner. And I guess my goal, I thought, I want to write a book about this that won't end up in that corner.
Yeah, yeah. Speaking of thought-provoking and fascinating, talk with us about some of the systems of writing, of preserving stories these pre-Columbian societies had.
Well, there are all kinds of different ways. First, there are many societies, of course, that did it orally. But in Mesoamerica, there's more than a dozen different writing schemes known, of which only a few have been translated. Part of the reason we know so little is that the Spaniards were freaked out by the presence of these different forms of writing and went to a great deal of trouble to burn all the books they could find. And for the Maya, there's only four, scraps of four books left. They're incredibly thorough. But we are able to, they had lots and lots of public inscriptions, the kind of things that are on statues and parks, right? And we have been able to decipher things from them. The same were all these other, lots and lots of other Mesoamerican societies also had forms of writing. Then you go down to Peru, and something that's completely fascinating to me, and there's a little appendix about it because I was sort of more fascinated than there was really room in the main book, is what's called quipu. And the quipu are a form of record keeping that's completely unlike anything else in the world. You have a long string, and then dangling from it are lots and lots of other they have knots in them. And people would run their fingers along the strings and record information. It's quite clear from the colonial records that this was it's not writing because it's not, inside, it's not putting stuff on paper or something, but it's a form. These were words, and there's an effort now just beginning to decipher them. Again, the Spaniards burned most of them, but there's more than 600 that are known to survive, and there's a determined effort to try and crack them. And this summer, after the publication of my book, a paper was published in Science that was the represents the first time that somebody's actually suggested what a particular configuration of knots means, an actual word for it.
Mm, really interesting. Knotted strings as a way of preserving information.
What, in a certain way, it's actually very logical. I mean, paper crumples up, right, and it gets ripped. And these things, you could crumple them up and then just pull them out. It was like carrying around a mop head. And they're very easily storable. They're very easily portable. They don't get damaged or stained in the way that paper does. In a certain way, it's actually extremely sensible. Problem is, of course, somebody has to tie all the knots.
Yeah. You know, years ago here in Champaign-Urbana, I saw a woman who was interested in agriculture and old crops.
Mm-hmm.
And she was interested in cotton that grows in color and how Native Americans, how they grew crops, and they would grow, you know, they did it differently than we do it. And another thing that she talked about was how they, I know this has been years now, but this is one of the reasons that I find the knotted string so interesting, is she was showing us how you could take a grasses, like a kind of a grass,
mm-hmm.
and you could sort it out. You could essentially unravel the stalk. And then she was proposing that you could, she had discovered a way how she could with one hand do that and knot it.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, there's a lot of braiding, which is, that's what that kind of thing is, that is also done in particularly in Peru, where they have very, very extraordinarily complex and sophisticated textiles, really quite amazing stuff. And my mother-in-law actually is a weaver and very interested in braiding. And so she was fascinated by, and sort of schooled me in some of this. So there's a great deal of this kind of craft that was developed over here and in Asia and is unfamiliar to Europeans.
Mm. Let's take some more calls. Next, we're going to go to a listener in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hi. I have a question about the northern people, specifically the Inuit versus the Indians in Alaska. The Inuit were, as I understand it, the same people from Greenland all the way across to Kotzebue Sound, and they're distinctly different, I think,
yes,
racially and culturally from the Indians who lived not that far south of them. And I wondered if you had any insight into the, you know, where each people came from.
Well, they are believed to have come in a much later migration. And you're quite right that when you say Indian, the folks way up north and who are called different names in different parts of Canada and the United States.
Yeah. Tlingits and so forth.
Right. And in certain places they have to be called the Inuit, and other places they refer Eskimo. So it's very complicated knowing what a good general term is. But in any case, these folks seem to have come across a few thousand years ago, much more recently than the people further south. And there's intriguing hints, sort of fascinating hints, generally not believed, but really sort of, I think, thought-provoking, that there may have been yet a third wave even before the wave of current Indians. There's as I say, no definitive proof, but there's sort of lots of interesting stuff that centers around that question.
So the Inuit culture and the Indian culture that existed just south of them
they're quite
Alaska
separate.
Are quite distinct.
Yes.
Because they were separate migrations of separate peoples, is that?
Yes, yes. And they probably came from slightly different parts of Asia as well. So in addition, there's a genetic separation, mm-hmm. and a separation of origin, as well as this temporal and cultural separation.
I see. Okay, well, thank you very much.
Sure.
Next, we talk with a listener on a cell phone. Line two, hi.
Hello. I have a question about religion in these older civilizations. I'm taking a class right now and studying the history of the urban environment, and we're just making it now to Mesoamerica. And I found it really interesting, the history of most cultures and their creation stories and the way religion fits into large urban centers. Do you know, does your research cover creation stories in this time period as well?
Yeah, there's lots and lots of compilations of these things. It's difficult of these kind of things. It's difficult to generalize because these societies are so diverse And so different from one from another that you kind of hear loose talk about, you know, Indian religion or Indian spirituality or that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, they're just extraordinarily different. So that the kind of religion that might have been practiced there where you are in the Midwest couldn't have been more different from what was practiced in Mesoamerica, which in turn couldn't have been more different from what was practiced in the Amazon. So, you know, and as for that reason, I think that you can find some Native American, you know, creation story or that would support almost any position you wanted to take. I guess that's a good position to be in if you wanted to do a doctorate or thesis or write a paper.
That's very interesting.
It is indeed. A follow-up from the listener?
Well, I had a second question.
Okay.
Also, one of the things that influenced a lot of really early civilizations is trade. So were there trade routes between these different kind of spaced out civilizations on this continent?
Oh, yes,
during that
yes.
period as well?
Yes, yes. Extensive trade networks, and they appear very early. You know, the Hopewell and Adena societies, which were you know near you guys, had trade networks that spanned most of the continent, most of North America, you know, there's evidence of stuff from these societies, you know, up here in Massachusetts, and there's even suggestions that their languages had an influence, and there's some theories, certainly not you know anything close to proven, that the Hopewell religion is a sort of a nationwide, if you like, religious revival, and that the elements of the Hopewell religion had a big impact as you know, way out in the East Coast and up in the Rocky Mountains.
Wow, very interesting. Thank you very much. I'm very looking forward to reading your book.
All right, thank you.
You're very welcome for the call, or we're taking the time to call, and good questions there. We're coming close to the end of the time that we have to spend together today. And, you know, as we've touched on this, that, you know, we're learning that these civilizations were more complex and technologically advanced than had been thought. With that in mind, is anyone working on taking what we've learned or what we're learning and applying these discoveries as solutions to contemporary problems?
Yes. One of the most interesting things that I learned in the course of researching my book is it has to do with the Amazon Basin. And your listeners may remember from seeing on calendars and so forth, the Amazon basin is in trouble because people are cutting down so much of the forest that covers a large part of it. And the reason this is bad, or thought to be bad, is that the soil of the Amazon is very poor. And when you remove the tree cover, the rain beats down and washes away the nutrients, and then the sun bakes, you know, the hot tropical sun, bakes the rest, the earth, into something that resembles brick. And so you create what ecologists sometimes call a wet desert. And fascinatingly, sort of along the river are lots and lots of places where they have what they call terra preta de los indios, which is black Indian earth. And it's long-lasting fertile soil that was created by the actions of the area's original inhabitants. And in fact, these areas of the soil are among the richest parts, you know, in terms of biodiversity of the Amazon Basin. And there's what they were able to do there was to transform poor soil into fertile soil that's lasted for centuries, because obviously, you know, they're not making much of it anymore. And there's a Brazilian, American, German, Japanese team that's trying to understand the techniques to learn how they did it so that it could be applied in other areas like in Africa and Asia where poor soil is a major reason for poverty.
Mm, very interesting. There we have to leave it. We're out of time. We left one listener unable to answer, to ask his or her question, but we're just out of time, I'm sorry to say. Charles Mann, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Charles Mann is a science journalist. He is the author of five books, one of them, 1491. That's the book we've been talking about this afternoon in this portion of the afternoon magazine. 1491, New Revelations of the Americas Before Columbus. The book is now available in paperback with a new afterword from Vintage Books. And our guest, Charles Mann, he will be in Chicago next week for a talk at the Field Museum. That event set for Thursday, October 19th, 2006.